Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In today's program, contributing host Doug Becker spends the hour exploring the politics of memory and altering history. What can we learn about how our memories of the past are manipulated to change current and future politics? What can we learn from memory entrepreneurs in the former Yugoslavia? How did they try to change understandings about the past to influence the future?
I'm Doug Becker. In February 2018, Poland passed a law that criminalized references to Polish crimes in the Holocaust. This was later changed to a civil offense. It's a campaign by Polish nationalists to rid the nation of what they call education of shame. This mirrors many nationalist governments in Eastern Europe, nations formerly behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War, in altering their memory of the Holocaust and the national roles in it. On today's show, we will address these developments, which are outlined with depth and precision in Yelena Subotok's new book, Yellow Star, Red Star. We have the author, Yelena Subotok, professor of political science at Georgia State University, as well as two experts on issues of memory and history, Brent Steele, the Francis D. Warmoth Presidential Chair of Political Science and Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah, and author of several works including Ontological Security in International Relations, and Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington, whose publications include Theorizing States' Emotions. So first we'll turn to Yelena. What exactly was your book about and what motivated your interest in examining the different ways in which Eastern European countries are altering their memory and their history of the Second World War?
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. My book was motivated in part by developments like those you describe in Poland. I began to observe a pattern of Holocaust revisionism and, in general, revisionism of both the history of World War II and history of communism in the entire post-communist space. So I wanted to investigate why the process of revisionism has occurred, what manifestations we can discern, what patterns we can demonstrate, and what are the ways in which states and societies in post-communist Eastern Europe, how are they remembering or misremembering crimes of both the Holocaust and crimes of communism. So in my book, I make an argument that states of post-communist Eastern Europe after communism are dealing with a very deep sense of insecurity about their identity, about who they are after communism, what has happened to them, what is their past, what is their history, are they the villains or the heroes of their past, how do they fit within this new European framework, are they the real Europeans or are they Europeans on the periphery? And in making that argument, I use the case of Holocaust remembrance in three countries that are the core of my empirical investigation. These countries are Croatia, Serbia, and Lithuania. And I specifically wanted to look at countries that are less known in the historiography of the Holocaust, especially the countries of the Balkans, Serbia and Croatia, and compare them with countries that are more known in the history of the Holocaust, such as Lithuania. And I wanted to look at how the different experience of World War II in these regions, the different experience of the Holocaust and how Holocaust played out, the different experiences of communism in the two regions then impacted how they're remembering the Holocaust today. So the book really goes into detail about what are the museums of history like in these countries today, how do they represent their past, how do they represent the Holocaust, how do they represent their own local complicity and collaboration in the Holocaust, how do they represent cases of anti-Semitism, how was that represented during the long period of communism, 50 years in the case of Yugoslavia, 75 in the cases further in the east, and then what happened after communism was over, how did these new countries that were really interested in becoming European and joining the EU, how do they deal with this very problematic and difficult past?
Brent Steele, I'm going to ask this of you. What exactly is at stake in some of these conversations? Why is a nation's history and the conception of their own history so important to their conception of themselves and perhaps their foreign policy?
Thanks for having me on. Yelena's book really demonstrates why and how history matters for the present and the future. So it doesn't really matter whether we're talking about individuals or groups or states, everyone kind of wants continuity and order. across time and space. And so that's basically the fundamental assumption of this concept that comes up in Yelena's book, and as you referred to in one of the books that I've written on, this concept of ontological security. Ontological security is about the securing of the self through time and space to provide a sense of continuity and order in events. And the problem is that one of the ways in which we try to do that is to provide routines. So routines are one way in which we can generate a sense of continuity and order. But we're also depending upon so many other things that are out of our control. And one of the possibilities for creating a sense of order in the present is to look to the past and to say, well, this is what we were like, or this is what we did, or this is what we experienced, either as an individual or as a group or as a state. And this is what our past was like, and this is how we handled it, and this is what was done to us then. And so we're going to do something similar now. And what she is showing in this book is that one of the ways to do that is to actually recreate the past so that you can make sense of the present. But the problem is that in that attempt to generate some kind of continuity and order in the present by going back to a past and reinterpreting it, you're really generating lots of problems, both in terms of how you're interpreting the past and also the types of stories you're telling about the present. And so that's, I think, the key aspect that's coming through in this book and also in the politics that are happening, as you noted at the very beginning, across some of these states and some of these regions.
Brent Sasley, these are some extremely emotional issues. So at least partially what's at stake, I'm sure, are the reactions of local populations, the way they conceptualize their own history. I mean, one of the things that strikes me in the book is Yelena actually shares stories about her own family's past. We'll get into those in just a moment. But kind of broadly, how emotional are these responses versus kind of more of a rational, you know, this is the way in which I want to express my national image in the international sphere versus just something that's very heartfelt and opening up old wounds?
Well, I would say that emotions or emotional states are pretty critical to this kind of process. And we can have a discussion about how much emotions are at the core or not of ontological security processes. But I think when you have a group of people that identifies as belonging to a particular collectivity, collective memory is a crucial part of that identity and that sense of belonging. But people don't like to really emphasize traumatic pasts. They don't like to emphasize traumatic pasts in the sense of any traumas that they might have visited on others. They are, I'll use the word okay, they're not really okay with it, but they are more comfortable with recognizing the traumatic past if they've been the victims of it, because that becomes a not just a collective memory, but a vehicle for telling stories about who they are, where they're going, what's happening to them now, what kinds of rights or compensations or demands are legitimate for them to promote now. I'm thinking of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where both sides often talk about their centuries or their long history of victimhood as a way of informing what they should be allowed to do now or why they should have the support of international actors or the international community. I think people, one of the things that that ties members of a group together isn't just their sense of I'm a member of this group, but their sense of identification with the group itself. And so things that affect the group are seen as affecting the individual, even if an individual wasn't even alive at the time. And so all of these things that the book that Yelena is talking about are things that individuals today find deeply problematic because it raises questions about things that they might have done, they being the group. And that's hard to process at both the individual and the collective level.
Yelena, one of the themes here, and this is certainly a theme in the book, is this question of, was I the perpetrator or was I the victim? And in particular, there's two different groups or two different nations that could be the perpetrators. If the state that is asserting that they're not the victim, usually they were victimized by either the Nazis or the communists. So let's start with the communists in this case. What role does the Soviet state, you know, for Lithuania, for example, or just communism in general play as kind of an alternative foil? So we weren't the victimizers, we were the victims, and the true crime that we should focus on is communism.
The main framework within which we can begin to understand these very unusual and problematic practices of Holocaust remembrance today in Eastern Europe is through the prism of communism. Communism that started, obviously, in the 1940s in Soviet Union, so in my case of Lithuania, has a much longer relationship with communism, and in the case of Yugoslavia, starts in 1945. In those countries, communism completely rearranged public memory, and the memory of the Holocaust was completely suppressed. In many ways, this is the result of the simple fact that after the Holocaust, there were very few, if any, Jewish communities in much of this region. But for my purposes, more importantly, communism narrated the Holocaust exclusively through the prism of the heroic anti-fascist struggle, the way that they talked about it, of World War II and the glorification of the role of the Red Army, and also the victory of communism against fascism. So there was really no room for specific individual memorialization and also for ethnic memorialization. So there were no memorials or monuments to Jewish victims of the Holocaust. There were many memorials and monuments to victims of anti-fascism, under which many different groups would then fit. So this very long period of, in some ways, frozen Holocaust remembrance, slightly thawed, if you will, at the end of communism in 1991. And these countries suddenly were pressured by the West, mostly in their process of European Union accession, to engage with and have a dialogue with what by then has already solidified as a pretty linear Western European Holocaust narrative, which talks specifically about Jewish suffering, that distinguishes the Holocaust as a unique, distinct event from the larger context of World War II. And this Western memory of the Holocaust was very alien to East European countries, which, as I said, did not really have this experience throughout the entire period of communism. Instead, at the end of communism, what these countries hoped for is not that they would have to now talk about Holocaust, but reversely, that the West would now have to talk about the crimes of communism. So most of their memory emphasis was on how to persuade the West that crimes of communism were just as heinous, if not more, than the crimes of the Holocaust. They were really more interested, as we just talked about, in presenting themselves as the victims. And they resented deeply the continuing European push for them to remember the Holocaust as a distinct event and to specifically talk about their own very deep and very massive local collaboration and complicity in the Holocaust.
And Brent Sasley, I know you've been critical of the European project, at least as it relates to memory in Eastern Europe. How have Western European countries aided in this understanding of the Holocaust, this memory of the Holocaust, versus have they aided it or have they been a little bit less than helpful?
I think Yelena does an excellent job of discussing this in the book. I think, and it looks like when Europe is divided between East and West, you get different kinds of, you might even say you have different ontological security developments on both sides. They see their identities as a little bit different. Obviously, the East is under communism, under Soviet control, and the West develops differently. When the Soviet Union collapses and the East is struggling to find itself, it meets a Western part of the continent that had already had decades to solidify its sense of self and its sense of community and the kinds of things that identify that community as different. And so the West expects the East to suddenly catch up and to abide by, or to at least to adopt or adapt to the West's own identity and own sense of self and everything that entails, including its role in the Holocaust and how they remember it. But as I think, again, the book does an excellent job of pointing this out, the East tries to do that at least for a little bit, or they struggle with it. But at some point, it becomes clear for significant portions of the population of countries in the East, that's just not acceptable, both for their own sense of who they are and their own sense of worth and sense of self, but also because you have material changes taking place. you do have economic and social problems in Eastern countries, and what that does is it facilitates the emergence or reemergence of populist right-wing communities and groups trying to win power or seize power, and then use their position to spread their own ideology across the country. Those two things overlap, which I think leads to a challenge to the Western European conceptualization of Holocaust remembering. To the extent that Europe, Western Europe, or the EU plays some role in that process, I would suggest that the Western Europeans perhaps reacted a little bit unfairly by expecting a rapid adaptation to the European version before these countries even had a chance to come to grips with their own past. And I think that in that sense, they perhaps served as enablers of this new memorization or this new process of forgetting and remembering certain aspects of the past.
This actually makes me think of a number of the campaigns that we're seeing throughout the EU, kind of this European identity versus national identity, and how much of populist movements are groups that are pushing back against this notion of a European identity where their own identities would be subsumed. And it seems particularly salient, I think, in Eastern Europe, in part because, as Brent Sassley just said, they didn't really have a whole lot of time to sort through this. But Brent Steele, how much is this driven by a sense that we're going to lose our own identity if we become completely European, or at least allow the Europeans to define what it means to be Serbian, what it means to be Croat, what it means to be Lithuanian or Polish or whatever. So they're fighting, this is an example where they're fighting for their own identity against being subsumed into a European identity.
As Brexit demonstrates, they're not the only ones that are kind of resisting the idea of a European identity. There's a couple of things here, and I don't want to necessarily let any of these particular countries and some of the populist movements off the hook that we've just been talking about. But Jelena's book brings up the point that, and this is kind of a point that follows along what Brent Sassley just mentioned, that the Western European countries really haven't had a full, or they're not particularly open about accounting for their own past and their own roles and their own societal roles in carrying out the Holocaust. And so I think that would maybe be a way to sort of open up the possibility of what a full reckoning would look like in order to become European for Eastern Europe, as if certain Western European countries did that a little bit more. And you know, there's another factor here that I think is important when it comes to any sort of, for lack of a better term, retreat back to old national borders. And that is just this broader sort of structural or superstructural factor of late modernity or globalization. Everything that is happening around us is happening so quickly. It feels like events are completely out of control. There are particular generations that are older that remember the past in certain ways, nostalgize it in certain ways. They actually have an outsized power in some of these societies, these aging societies. And so they can seek to control a narrative that says, well, one of the ways in which we can handle all this chaos and all this speed is to go back to, of late modernity, is to go back to one of the core institutions of modernity, and that is the state. And that is borders, sovereign borders as we remembered them. And so part of this, I think, that's happening in the countries that are of focus here that we've been talking about so far is something that's actually happening more broadly. I mean, you're seeing this, obviously, in the United States. You're seeing it in some of the voices that are animating Brexit. And I'm not 100% sure that it's not happening more broadly elsewhere as well. So those are just a couple of things that I wanted to mention, not to necessarily let off the hook any of these countries in terms of the way in which they're enforcing these nationalisms and these notions of borders as a resistance to European identity that also imperils some of these populations within their borders as well.
Brent Sassley?
I think Brent raised a really good point, which is that the way that we remember the Holocaust, it's a relative thing. So if you compare, let's say, Western Europe to Eastern Europe, it looks, in that comparison, it looks like the West has done a much better job of remembering and compensating either financially or in some other way. But it's relative. I mean, even in Western Europe, Germany has done a far better job of coming to grips with its role in its past than places like Italy, France, Britain. I mean, even Israel is still struggling with how to conceive of or how to remember the Holocaust. And so it's not that the Western Europe has done a perfect job or has done a better job. It's still struggling with this. But it's the idea is that it started to do something. And then perhaps in some ways that made it worse because it expected Eastern Europe to then catch up to its only half finished or incomplete version of remembrance.
So, Yelena, one of the things that's most impressive about this book is the archival research and some of the personal stories that you were able to uncover. So first off, I just learned about a lot of instances, a lot of sites of genocide during the Holocaust, and I just didn't realize I didn't know until I read your book. So first, you do tell some personal stories about your own family, and I imagine part of that is if you're going to write a book on memory, you should probably sort of reveal your own. But how difficult was it in the interactions with the local populations, local historians or people who are keeping these sites, to open up these wounds to tell these stories?
It was very clear to me from the beginning that I was going to write a different type of book, the one that really includes people, individual stories. It was very important to me to individualize these histories as much as possible. I did not want to write a clinical narrative about the Holocaust that in its own was basically dehumanization and removal of people's identities, and I didn't want to do that with my scholarly work. So I had a very clear idea when I started the book that this is going to be the book that will have many stories and people and individual vignettes in it. And so I kind of thought about how to do that, and I decided to anchor in some ways each country, each chapter around one particular story that was complex in its own way, but really at a very individual level talked about the horrors of the Holocaust and then also the horrors of forgetting about it. As you mentioned, I do talk a little bit about my own family history, and that's interesting because I did not write the book after I found out the family history. It was the opposite. I found out the family history as I started writing the book. So it's a different kind of emotional reckoning. So it was also, as it was clear to me that I needed to put people in it, I wanted to put myself in it only to the extent that I thought ethically as a scholar of memory, I need to talk about my own responsibility. And as a scholar of, you know, in international ethics and accountability, I need to talk about my own accountability. So it was very clear that I had to put that in the book, but I did not know the extent of involvement of, for example, my grandfather in the Holocaust. So what I found out as I was researching in this particular case, the role of the Serbian collaborationist government under the Nazi occupation, I discovered that my grandfather was chief of special police for a couple of months, not for a very long time, but for a couple of months, right as the occupation started in 1941, and that he was in charge of the entire special police of the city of Belgrade, and under him was a section that was, the name of it was for Jewish affairs. And basically that section reported to him, and that section, the job of that section was to register Jews, take away their property, and enforce all the anti-Jewish laws that the occupation put in place. And so what I discovered in the process of research, and I found that archival material in the U.S. Holocaust Museum, I discovered reports that he received and that he himself wrote back to the main government of the main Quisling collaborationist government in Serbia, where he reports how many Jews were registered, what kind of property was taken from them, and how those who did not obey with, for example, wearing yellow red star insignia and armbands, how his unit arrested those Jews and gave them away to the Gestapo. And so I was, uh, it was it was very hard to read those documents and to see his signature on them and to realize that my own grandfather was a cog in the occupation machine, and that he has reported back, and probably under his watch, some Jews were arrested, sent to the Gestapo, and you know, most likely nothing good happened to them. So I had to wrestle with that, and I had a lot of concerns about how to appropriately present that information so that the book doesn't become about me or my family or my grandfather. That's not important, but how to really contextualize what collaboration is like. And so I used the example of my grandfather as to really talk about how what collaboration means, and how being a cog in the machine makes you a collaborationist willingly, unwillingly, for various reasons, for professional reasons, for reasons of professional ambition, maybe, or advancement, or fear. And so I use that example more not to talk about me or how important my family was, because it wasn't really very important, but to talk about the complexity of what we understand is when we use the term collaboration or complicity or quisling, what do we mean? And what's the everyday under collaboration like? And what's the everyday under occupation like? And for the ethical consequence of my work, which was very important to me, to talk about what do we do with that kind of memory? So what is my responsibility as a scholar in discussing memory of my family and memory of others? And especially, how do I include memory of victims in the memory of my own family, which did not process to this day the role that my grandfather had, and really did not understand the extent of his involvement, and didn't really precisely put a name to what he did.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel members are Yelena Sobotuk, professor of political science at Georgia State University and author of several works, including Yellow Star, Red Star; Brent Steele, the Francis D. Warmoth Presidential Chair of Political Science and professor of political science at the University of Utah, and author of several works, including Ontological Security in International Relations; and Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington, whose publications include Theorizing States Emotions. Part of this process that I find particularly fascinating then is we've got these intensely personal stories and individual decisions, but how much can we relate that to a national experience? So when I think of atrocities like the Holocaust, what immediately would come to mind as a young scholar in particular was asking myself, what would I have done in that situation? So how much does the nation have complicity versus individuals have complicity? And I think this is one of those complex questions, Brent Steele, that is kind of at the core of ontological security and this notion of the desire of the protection of the self, is because I know that this theory is derived from psychology and talks a lot about the individual. How transferable is the individual to the state?
I'll just kind of reverse that and say, as a start to my answer, and say, well, how, I mean, we know that the state is transferring to individuals. Mm-hmm. And I mean, at the very end of Yelena's book, she's showing something that ontological security scholars have been talking about for a while. And that is that whether we want to justify the move of an individual level process to states or not, states are doing it anyway. States are driving towards an ontological security that ultimately is an illusion. I mean, any time that you do what Yelena calls heavy-handed attempts at reappropriating memory in the present for the purposes of securing the identity of the state, you're ultimately going to lead to insecurity. But not only for the state, but it also has consequences for individuals. So at the very end of her book, she brings up Poland and in Ukraine, where there are these big pushes that are happening at the national level, but they're filtering down into rallies, protests, modes of social movement organization that are imperiling particular groups like the Roma in Ukraine and other groups in Poland. And so even if we want to argue that the move towards identity really should stay, in terms of how we analyze it, should stay at the individual level of analysis, these types of things and the processes of collective seeing themselves as a self happen at the level of states and other groups. And those have huge implications for not just the ontological insecurity of the individuals that are imperiled, that don't have a place and a space in those moves towards national identity in a particular political community, but they have huge implications for their physical security as well. And this is not only happening in some of the contexts that Professor Subotic's book is looking at. You mentioned Poland at the very beginning, Doug, and you know, other ontological security scholars see how this is happening elsewhere quite frequently. It's obviously happening in India with Modi's nationalism and a particular form of Hindu nationalism imperiling other individual groups. So there have been defenses in terms of how you can study individual level processes at the levels of states, but a very quick answer to it is to just look at the narratives and discourses that talk about the state as a collective, as both an inclusionary moment of identity, this is who we are, and also a moment of excluding, this is who we are not, or this is who is not allowed into our political community. And when you look at it that way and just set it up at different levels and looking at the different drives for ontological security at different levels and what that does, it provides a particularly, I think, sharp account of the dynamics of conflict within societies and across societies as well.
And they also tend to express national identity through an individual leader or through individual image. You know, I think the case of Ukraine that's brought up at the end, the role of an individual like a Bandera, how should Bandera be remembered or how should different leaders? And I think in particular, since Yelena talks about Serbia and Croatia and has those as two cases, there's definitely individuals that become the expression of the state's memories, particularly fascinating. But then there ends up being this debate between who was the actual person or who were the actual figures versus what's our memory of those figures. I know frequently when historians will release new biographies or new histories and reveal something that's counter-narrative about an individual, these become extremely intensely contested issues domestically. I know, Brent Sasley, you're familiar with a lot of these, in particular your research within Israel and the role that individuals have played. Do you have perhaps, you know, other examples, or how on to this process of individualizing history do you think I am?
Well, I think Brent Steele had it right that states are simply large collectivities. They are just like any other group, defined by some set of ascriptive characteristics, and in the case of states, by set of internationally legally recognized borders, or borders that they claim that often are legally recognized. And like any group, they have a set of collective memories and a set of ideas that they identify as part of their self-identification. In the case of a state, because typically they are such large populations, what you do have you have two processes going on. First, you do have multiple groups often contesting with each other over whose memories or which memories get to be predominant and how they are remembered. And then also you have among those groups, you typically will have a hegemonic group. In the case of states, it's usually an ethno-national community that, quote, founded the state or created the contemporary state. And they tend to occupy many of the positions of power that allow them to set these memories and how they are interpreted. But for a state, you also have an authorized leader. And I don't mean authorized in the sense of necessarily having had internal elections, although in a democracy you might, but you have leaders who are considered to be representatives and spokespeople of the state. And so they get to set the boundaries of what is remembered and how it is remembered. When those leaders are replaced, and I think the examples from the book help illustrate this, when those leaders are replaced, you might get other ways of remembering. And so you do have this constant process of contestation, but that's because a state, like any group, is in a constant process of constructing and reconstructing and deconstructing its identity. It doesn't really end. It kind of keeps going. And leaders, particularly when you have groups that disagree or have very different perceptions of the future of the country and what it should look like, leaders can have very different ideas about what those memories should be. And so getting people in power or people coming to power who have a radically different version of the past and what the future should look like based on that past, yes, you do get those individuals can play an important role in memory making, but I would suggest that they are still just vehicles. They are representative of a particular kind of idea that happens to now be in a position of power to promote those ideas or those memories.
Absolutely. And I mean, what's kind of striking with this is my first introduction to memory studies years ago, the author that would come to mind is George Orwell, and this notion of just rewriting history and throwing the old history down the memory hole and creating the new history. And some of my reaction to that was, that's not the way memories are created. There's no one individual actor that has, you know, that level of power. The memory has to reside someplace in a narrative. Maybe it's a different interpretation of the narrative, or obviously leaving out certain parts of the narrative. And Yelena Subotuk, this is exactly what a number of your chapters indicate. I'd like to turn to the Croatia chapter, because you describe the memory appropriation that the Croat government has engaged in really since the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. You call this memory divergence, sort of defined as taking the Holocaust, decoupling it from all other crimes to making it uniquely Nazi, which is striking to me, of course, because my understanding of Croat history during the Second World War was quite a bit of collaboration between the Croat Ustashi state and the Nazis. So part of the question I'm asking is, you know, how do they do this? Are they just simply whitewashing out their parts, their collaborations, and saying all these crimes were committed, you know, by the Nazis, so that that clears their role in the Holocaust, so that they are no longer perpetrators? And so is it safe to say it's a partial history, or how much are they altering history, and how much are the stories they're telling that just doesn't bear resemblance to the actual facts of what happened historically?
Croatia did more than just collaborations. Croatia established its own Nazi puppet statelet called the Independent State of Croatia that was run autonomously and independently from the Nazis with Nazi support, and it was a Nazi ally, but it ran administratively completely on its own. And so Croatia during World War II, this Independent State of Croatia, the fascist Independent State of Croatia, had a network of its own concentration and death camps that were run independently from the Germans. And so that is the real crux of Holocaust memory in Croatia, that you can blame the Germans, but the killing was done by Croats. And so that is a very, very difficult place to remember, and a very difficult thing to process. And it makes it different from other countries under occupation, where we can talk about, like in Serbia, where we can talk about collaboration, but most of the killing, if not all of the killing, was actually done by Germans. That's not the case in Croatia. So the memory divergence that I talk about is really the attempt, and quite successful narrative attempt, by the contemporary post-communist, post-Yugoslav Croatian state to separate the crimes of the Holocaust and say that, yes, these are horrible crimes, it's horrible what happened to the Jews, but this was a Nazi-German thing, Nazis made us do this, from the auxiliary killing and mass atrocity that happened under the same regime, in the same camps, by the same perpetrators against other non-Croat civilians, mostly Serbs, but also Roma. Almost the entire Roma population of Croatia was annihilated in the Holocaust, about 25,000 people. 300,000 Serbs were killed by the Ustasha, 17% of pre-war Croatian Serb population. So we're talking really about a complete eradication of groups of people that were done by the Ustasha regime and not by the Nazis. In fact, as I talk at length in the book, a lot of this auxiliary killing of non-Jews under the shadow of the Holocaust was done by the Croatian Ustasha to some annoyance of Germans, who kept saying, well, you know, you're kind of wasting your time and your bullets on these other groups. We want the Jews killed. And so what I discovered, and what I talk about in the book, is how memory has diverged, where the crimes against the Jews are to some extent recognized. The Croatian government sends delegations to Yad Vashem, and they have good relations with Israel, and they talk about the tragedy of the Holocaust, and the capital city of Zagreb is now planning to put up a very spectacular museum of the Holocaust. But they're narrating that story as the story where the Germans gave all the directives and organized all the killing, which is not true. But they're completely separating, diverging that memory of Jewish suffering from memory of Serbian and Roma suffering, which had nothing to do with the Nazis, which was really an organically creation project. And that is because this continues to be a very difficult issue for the remaining Serbs who live in Croatia. And it's completely conflated with a more recent memory of Croatian-Serbian war in the 1990s. And so for both more recent and for very contemporary political needs, it's simply more useful for Croatia to go through the motions of recognizing Holocaust victims, but deflecting that blame to Germany while completely ignoring its own responsibility and really genocidal intent against local Serbs and Roma.
Now, you said something in there I find particularly fascinating, because you have these recent memories. When most conflict scholars are examining Serbian-Croatian memory, the 1990s war is what seems to immediately come to mind, and the way in which Croatia was trying to present itself in the West as being, they were the good guys in the war, the Serbs were the ones who were committing the crimes. And by the way, part of the reason for that is Croats were not responsible for crimes during the Second World War. I actually remember a speaker, I vaguely remember a speaker trying to argue that although the Croats created an independent state supported by the Nazis, it was the Serbs who were the actual Nazis. They were the ones who were committing all these crimes, and highlighted all of a number of those crimes, some of which that you highlight in the book about Serb collaboration, but then completely whitewashing their own role. So how much of that is at stake in the ongoing campaign on the part of the Croats to present themselves as, we're the good guys out of the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, they're the ones who are the real criminals, they're the ones that you should identify as, you know, as causing the war, and they were the ones who committed all the atrocities.
Right. Well, that's a critical issue, because the way in which Croatia defined its own national identity after the breakup of the former Yugoslavia is as this very pro-European, Western, culturally European, politically European state that was destroyed by this savage aggression by the Serbs. And that's the role that that Croatia worked very hard to present to the European Union. And finally, it was successful. Croatia is the latest EU member state that joined in 2014. And so this narrative of Croatia being pro-European, being on a good side of history, being always allied with the West, and being besieged by savages. I mean, if you really look at kind of the narrative of Serbs in the Croatian press and Croatian media and Croatian politicians, it's a very orientalist narrative that these Serbs are kind of these barbarians at the gates. But of course, that is a falsification of Croatia's World War II narrative. And as I said, it's a conflation of what happened with 1990s, because it is absolutely true, and Croatia is correct, that it was a victim of aggression, mostly from Serbia proper, and then also by Serbia proper arming Serb rebels in Croatia with you know, heavy artillery, who then fought against Croatia's independence. So Croatia has a lot of legitimate reason to be upset about its story in the 1990s, and both the Serbian and the Croat-Serbian troops committed unimaginable atrocities against Croatian civilians in the war in the 1990s. But that is not the entirety of the Croatian story. So what Croatia, of course, refuses to admit are crimes against humanity and war crimes that Croatian army has committed against Serbian civilians in the war of the 1990s, but also this really horrendously traumatic history of the independent state of Croatia, which was committing genocide against Serbs and perpetrated a complete Holocaust of its Jews. And so I call this in the book unusable memory. Croatia doesn't know what to do with its memory. And then it's trying to come up with various narrative structures and various divergent tactics to deflect the crimes onto a known villain, which are the Nazis, and really hide under the carpet its own very deep and incredibly important complicity.
Absolutely. So what immediately comes to mind, Brent Steele, is this notion of ontological security, because its security is in is at the foundation of the concept, it at least invites us to think of it as being defensive in nature, the idea of needing to act in some way to defend your identity, to defend your image, your conception of your own self against some sort of a threat. First of all, is that a too narrow definition of ontological security? Because if we can expand the definition, now we can start talking even more about, you know, are states like, say, Croatia, with their desire to join the EU, are they defending their sense of self? Are they actually engaging in kind of an aggressive alteration of history so that then they can tell a much more consistent narrative? But it's not really about themselves. It's a consistent narrative that they're presenting to another audience, in the case of Croatia, Western Europe, so that they can join the EU.
I think that you actually have it. It's both narrow and it's broad. So what an ontological security system is supposed to do is to take the anxiety that's just a condition for any of us in the chaos of late modern life, including states in international relations, and try to reduce it so that it's manageable. And one of the ways in which historically people have handled anxiety, and psychologists have talked about this for ages, is to turn anxiety into fear. So to take that anxiety, which is a general sort of unease, but an unknown over what the unease is about, and transfer that to an identifiable object that we can fear. But then that's a way to sort of target and channel anxieties into something that can be managed. That is the object of fear. So the security system then is defending against something ultimately that is really, really narrow. But it's a choice in terms of how to turn that anxiety into something that is definite. And a lot of times the definite object is something that nobody really needs to fear, but it's constructed as something that needs to be feared. So states, societies do this a lot with migrants, right? They take a sort of sense of anxiety, for instance, economic anxiety or anxiety over the world changing around them. And that's something that you can't necessarily control. And you say, well, actually, the reason why our world right now is so messed up isn't necessarily because of just economics or just the cultures around us. It's because of these people here. So you turn anxiety into fear and you point to the migrant or something else as something that is disturbing. And what Yelena's book is showing is that the past is something that can be rearranged, diverged, converged, conflated, in a way that you can take the past that might generate anxiety, especially if you were involved in some of the things that were really problematic years and years ago, and change it so that you were a victim in the past, a victim of an identifiable threat, the Nazis in the past, and a victim in the present of an identifiable threat, whether it's migrants or something else. And so that's one of the ways in which something that is broad, ontological insecurity based out of anxiety, and you turn it into something that's rather narrow, ontological security attained by having a definite object that we're supposed to fear.
And Brent Sasley, I mean, first of all, if we're talking about fear, we're certainly talking about an emotional response. It's one question that I always wrestle with is how much of this process is instrumental. It's been outlined by political actors who are trying to get something material, frequently material and concrete, from these reactions versus just kind of this normal response. Fear certainly is a normal response in certain circumstances. But is this being manipulated for some purpose, or is it just simply something that's felt and expressed by political communities?
I think that's a good question. And I think it's one that scholars who work on emotions often wrestle with. I think that the fear is certainly important. There is a genuine fear that some other group, they are not like us, and therefore they serve as a threat to us. And I mean, that's how Donald Trump and many of his supporters view immigrants, as Brent Steele said. This is how the right-wing Jewish governments in Israel under Netanyahu and the Likud view not just Arab citizens of Israel and not just left-wing critics, but anyone else who is different as well. That is I'll use the word normal, but that is a normal fear. But there is a material aspect to it, and that is that these groups fear that their, quote, country will not only change, but they themselves will lose power. And that everything that they, all of the benefits that accrue to them by being in these positions of power and controlling the state and controlling memory making and all of that will be gone. Or that's how they view it, that they will lose. Almost as if it's a zero-sum game, that, that if others more of a get to play some role in the shaping of state identity or group identity, then this these hegemonic groups or members of these hegemonic groups, they will lose some corresponding amount. So I think that the overlap is important to think about. And then sort of a third aspect to it, the material aspect also comes in when you think about national policy, when you think about state policy. So borders, there are still lots of states that are, if not struggling over their borders, at least trying to define them or reshape them or harden them in the face of changes or you know, many years of not having had that border finalized. Israel, of course, is a very good example. Kosovo might be another good example, speaking of Eastern Europe. When states are trying to define a hard material border in the face of efforts to rechange it or to resist that border, or to resist where those borders are, that's a material interest that lies or that is connected to that fear.
As we draw to a close, Yelena, your last chapter really makes a compelling and passionate argument that these divergent memories are creating, first of all, just sort of a lack of honesty with what the community has done with the past. And also, I would imagine, you know, potential lines of conflict. And you call for a memory solidarity. So I guess, I mean, at one level, the idea that, I mean, could we, through a transnational memory, just come to an agreement as to the meaning of the Holocaust and what we should all be remembering about it, especially because there's always new historical research, there's always new archives that are opening or stories that are being told. Can we achieve a memory solidarity? And if so, how is that to be managed? I mean, is this something that's going to be negotiated between states? Who holds the key to creating the memory that would be the memory that we all agree to at some level for memory solidarity?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. Of course, that's very hard. So it's an aspirational idea. What I meant by memory solidarity is not a fixed memory. I don't expect, and I don't think it's a good thing to expect a fixed memory of really anything. I mean, as you just said, things change, historiography changes, archives open up. What we today understand about the Holocaust is very different than what we understood, for example, before the end of communism and before the Soviet archives opened up and we could finally peek into a completely different set of experiences in the Soviet Union that we were not privy to before. And so I'm not asking for a fixed memory that we can all sign off on and like a checklist. What I meant by memory solidarity is simply the idea that we should experience or try to empathize with the memory of others. And we talked about it, about this earlier, and Brent Sasley brought this up multiple times, this idea that groups, individuals, but also groups, are much more likely to remember the past in which they're either heroes or victims. And in fact, in the cases that I study, this memory of your own victimization becomes the foundational block of your narrative identity construction. And I think that that alone is a cause of great concern, because the memory of your own victimization clouds, if not shuts off all memory of you in maybe a different role. So what I ask for is for these countries, and again, as we talked about, this applies just as much to the West as it applies to the East, to remember the memory of others and the memories that are not our own, to include in our own accountability, responsibility for the past, understanding of the past that is not our own, and to not focus only on our own suffering and our own victimization and our own pain and our own delegitimation and disenfranchisement and deportations and all the horrors that most countries in Eastern Europe experienced quite clearly by both the Nazis and later the Soviets, but to actually incorporate in our own corpus of memory the memory of those who can no longer speak because there's nobody to speak on their behalf.
The book is called Yellow Star, Red Star. It comes out within a month and raises some really fascinating questions about these memory appropriations, specifically in the case of Eastern Europe about the Holocaust, but some very interesting theoretical implications for the ways in which memories can be appropriated, the ways in which memories are altered, and the impacts that they have on political communities, on foreign policy, on voter preferences, and the way in which communities continue to interact with one another. I'd like to thank our panelists for a great conversation, encourage you to go out and buy the book. We've all read it. Yelena wrote it, and the rest have read it, and it is a fabulous book. And it's the one thing we absolutely all agree. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Our panel members were Yelena Subotoc, professor of political science at Georgia State University and author of several works, including Yellow Star, Red Star, Brent Steele, the Francis D. Warmoth Presidential Chair of Political Science and Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah, and author of several works including Ontological Security in International Relations, and Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington, whose publications include Theorizing States Emotions.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.